everybody. Welcome back to Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons. I'm your host, Kerry Parker. Today we have episode 375 for May 6th, 2024. Got a new show for you this week. Plenty of stories to catch you up on. As usual, kind of a mix between some good and some bad. Before we get to that, though, just want to let you know the new patron promotion was quite the success. We got a lot of new patrons. That is fantastic. Gave out some really cool Dragon Challenge coins along the way. And just FYI, the treasure part of the treasure and coin promo is something that's going to be ongoing, at least as long as I can keep prizes or treasure in the treasure chest. I will keep doing that. The proton codes have been very popular, but I've given away one of each of the three types I currently have, which is a Malwarebytes subscription and another subscription for Portmaster from Safing. I've managed to give out some of everything, but the proton ones are definitely the most popular ones, so those will probably run out not too much longer. I told them I would try to make them last a year, so I don't know if I'm going to get through the year with those, but we'll see. I hope to find some other partners for this to get some other kind of codes in there too. So anyway, that should be an ongoing thing. And as far as the Dragon Challenge coin goes, if you missed this promotion, I will do one again in the future. I'm hoping maybe for the end of this year, we'll see. Maybe something around the 400th episode. Maybe I'll do one then. All right, another quick update from last week when we talked to Seth about cryptocurrency from nation states. I also briefly mentioned Samurai Wallet. There's a lot of crap that went down with them. Seth wrote extensively about this and is of the strong opinion that it was not a good use of our law enforcement time to go after this. I actually added some links to the show notes of last week's episode around this. I don't know how many of your podcast clients will refresh the show notes if they change. But you could always go to the podcast's main website. You can either go to podcast.firewalls.dragons.com or go to firewalls.subdragons.com and click on the podcast link. It'll take you there. And by the way, because of the way podcast clients generally work, you never get to see the artwork that I pick out for each of these episodes, which I spend time doing, in some cases making myself. But most podcast clients don't show the per episode artwork. So, hey, you know, hey, if you ever want to see what that looks like, either follow me on social media because I usually post the episodes there with that artwork, or go to the podcast website and you can kind of poke around and see it there. All right. So one last thing. Thank you very much to one of my newsletter subscribers who pointed out that the DMARC, that's D-M-A-R-C, and I'm not going to go into too much of what that is now, but the settings for the newsletter weren't set properly. So that means that a lot of email providers now will mark that as spam. Hopefully I fixed that. So thank you very much for bringing that to my attention. I just had to tweak a couple settings because basically for the newsletter, it's coming quote unquote from me, but it's being sent on my behalf by my newsletter provider. And so I actually had to add some stuff to allow them to basically send on my behalf in a valid kind of way. So anyway, that's been fixed. And hopefully if you're a newsletter subscriber, if you were seeing, you know, notes that say, hey, this might be spam, hopefully that will stop now. And thanks again very much to the newsletter subscriber who pointed that out to me. Okay, so we've got a new show for you today. I very briefly mentioned that the U.S. Congress passed an expanded version of the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Section 702 law that has to be re-upped every so often, and they've been re-upping it ever since 9/11, basically. And this year, instead of actually paring it back, which we were trying to do, as we being privacy advocates, they actually struck down the warrant requirements for U.S. citizen information and expanded what could be collected. So it was really awful. I'm going to talk to you about that by reading an article from the EFF. Also, the U.S. Congress passed and Joe Biden, the president, signed a bill that would ban TikTok if ByteDance doesn't sell the app. In the UK, the Investigatory Powers Act is set to become law despite a lot of opposition. Also, the photo sharing community IM, which is EYEEM, not the letters I and M, like instant messaging, I guess, was taken over by another company. And now they've changed their terms of service in a really shady way to basically allow them to train AI models based on your information if you don't delete it first, and it's not that easy to do. Also, big healthcare breaches were in the news this week. Healthcare insurance giant Kaiser notified millions of people about a data breach, and then the Change Healthcare company, which is part of or merged with or related to United Healthcare, had hackers break in using stolen credentials, which affected like almost half of U.S. health insurance customers. I've got an article about how hackers used an antivirus service to infect people with malware. But I've got a few positive stories too. The FCC has fined cellular carriers here in the U.S. about $200 million for illegally sharing user information, and hopefully we'll be cracking down on that going forward. Jen Easterly, who's the CISA, the Cybersecurity Information Security Administration, it's such an awkward name, CISA, the cybersecurity agency in the U.S., the director, is pushing for more vendor accountability and less emphasis on victims' errors. I think that's a great thing. There's also some success stories about how CISA has hopefully prevented a lot of ransomware type attacks through its vulnerability scanning program, and some really amazing news out of the UK. They have become the first country to ban default passwords on IoT devices, but that is just the tip of the iceberg. They have passed a really, really strong and absolutely fantastic IoT cybersecurity bill, which we're going to talk about. Also, net neutrality is back for now. And then finally, leading into the tip of the week, is an article about how Google has once again delayed killing third-party cookies in the Chrome browser. So we're going to talk about that, and then that will lead into my tip of the week, which is please quit Chrome, and I'll tell you why. So let's get to the news of my tip of the week. All right, first up, this is a little bit long. It's from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, but this is a really, really important topic, and it's a real shame what just happened. In fact, the title of this from the Electronic Frontier Foundation is "The U.S. Senate and Biden Administration Shamefully Renew and Expand FISA Section 702, Ushering in a 2-year expansion of unconstitutional mass surveillance." So I'm not going to have a lot to add to this. This article says it pretty well, but I want to go through this to make sure you're up to date on what is going on and what just happened. 1 week after it was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives, the Senate passed what Senator Ron Wyden called, quote, "one of the most dramatic and terrifying expansions of government surveillance authority in history," unquote. President Biden then rushed to sign it into law. The perhaps ironically named Reforming Intelligence and Security Act, or RISAA, RISA? I'll call it RISA, does everything but reform Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. RISA not only reauthorizes this mass surveillance program, it greatly expands the government's authority by allowing it to compel a much larger group of people and providers into assisting with their surveillance. The bill's only significant quote-unquote compromise is a limited 2-year extension of this mass surveillance. But overall, RISA is a travesty for Americans who deserve basic constitutional rights and privacy, whether they are communicating with people and services inside or outside the U.S. Section 702 allows the government to conduct surveillance on foreigners abroad from inside the United States. It operates in part through the cooperation of large telecommunication service providers. Massive amounts of traffic on the internet backbone are accessed, and those communications on the government's secret list are copied. And that's just one part of the massive, expensive program. While Section 02 prohibits the NSA and FBI from intentionally targeting Americans with this mass surveillance, these agencies routinely acquire a huge amount of innocent Americans' communications, quote-unquote, incidentally. The government can then conduct backdoor, warrantless searches of these incidentally collected communications. The government cannot even follow the very lenient rules about what it does with the massive amounts of information it gathers under Section 702, repeatedly abusing this authority by searching its database for Americans' communications. In 2021 alone, the FBI reported conducting up to 3.4 million warrantless searches of Section 702 data using Americans' identifiers. Given this history of abuse, it is difficult to understand how Congress could decide to expand the government's power under Section 02 rather than reining it in. One of RISA's most egregious expansions is its large but ill-defined increase of the range of entities that have to turn over information to the NSA and the FBI. This provision allegedly responds to a 2023 decision by the FISC Court of Review, which rejected the government's argument that an unknown company was subject to 702 for some circumstances. While the New York Times reports that the unknown company from this FISC opinion was a data center, this new provision is written so expansively that it potentially reaches any person or company with, quote, access to equipment, unquote, on which electronic communications travel or are stored, regardless of whether they are a direct provider. This could potentially include landlords, maintenance people, and many others who routinely have access to your communications on the interconnected internet. This is to say nothing of RISA's other substantial expansions. RISA changes FISA's definition of foreign intelligence to include counter-narcotics. This will allow the government to use FISA to collect information relating to not only the, quote, international production, distribution, or financing of illicit synthetic drugs, opioids, cocaine, or other drugs driving overdose deaths, unquote, but also to any of their precursors. While surveillance under FISA has, contrary to what most Americans believe, never been limited exclusively to terrorism and counterespionage, RISA's expansion to FISA to ordinary crime is unacceptable. RISA also allows the government to use Section 02 to vet immigrants and those seeking asylum. According to the FISC opinion released in 2023, the FISC repeatedly denied government attempts to obtain some version of this authority before finally approving it for the first time in 2023. By formally lowering Section 702's protections for immigrants and asylum seekers, RISA exacerbates the risk that government officials could discriminate against members of these populations on the basis of their sexuality, gender identity, religion, or political beliefs. Faced with massive pushback from EFF and other civil liberties advocates, some members of Congress, like Senator Ron Wyden, raised the alarm. We were able to squeeze out a couple of small concessions. One was a shorter reauthorization period for Section 702, meaning that the law will be up for review in just two more years. Also, in a letter to Congress, the Department of Justice claimed it would only interpret the new provision to apply to the type of unidentified businesses at issue in the 2023 Fisk opinion. But a pinky promise from the current Department of Justice is not enforceable and easily disregarded by a future administration. There is some possible hope here because Senator Mark Warner promised to return to the provision in a later defense authorization bill, but this whole debacle just demonstrates how Congress gives the NSA and FBI nearly free rein when it comes to protecting Americans. Any limitation that actually protects us, and here the FISA court actually did some protecting, is just swept away. RISA's passage is a shocking reversal. EFF and our allies had worked hard to put together a coalition aimed at enacting a warrant requirement for Americans and other critical reforms, but the NSA, FBI, and their apologists just rolled Congress with scary-sounding and incorrect stories, and those are links, by the way, I assume, to further information, that a lapse in the spying was imminent. It was clear dereliction of Congress's duty to oversee the intelligence community in order to protect all the rest of us from its long history of abuse. After over 20 years of doing it, we know that rolling back any surveillance authority, especially one as deeply entrenched as Section 702, is an uphill fight. But we aren't going anywhere. We had more congressional support this time than we've had in the past, and we'll be working to build that over the next 2 years. Too many members of Congress and the administration of both parties don't see any downside to violating your privacy and your constitutional rights in the name of national security. That needs to change. So yeah, I will just rubber stamp that. I don't think there was a single thing in there that I disagreed with. And it really is just an absolute travesty. I was so disheartened watching the debate on this in the House when they were trying to add the amendment that would require a warrant, and to see it go down in a tie was just heartbreaking. Okay, next up, another thing that our U.S. Congress has done that is just dumb. And this is from TechCrunch. And I've got a lot of articles today from TechCrunch, by the way. Anyway, it says, President Biden has signed a bill that would ban TikTok if its Chinese parent company, ByteDance, fails to sell it within a year. The bill, which includes aid for Ukraine and Israel, was passed by the U.S. Senate in a 79-18 vote late Tuesday, and this was a week or two ago, after the House passed it with an overwhelming majority over the weekend. The bill gives ByteDance 9 months to divest TikTok with a 90-day extension available to complete a deal. If ByteDance doesn't sell TikTok, it would become illegal for app stores to distribute the app in the U.S. In an emailed statement to TechCrunch, TikTok said it would challenge the quote-unquote unconstitutional law in court. The ban would not be a first for TikTok. 4 years ago, India banned the app following a military battle along the India-China border, and both Google and Meta quickly seized the opportunity to capture both local creators and TikTok users via their respective copycat products, YouTube Shorts and Instagram's Reels. Numerous other countries also banned the service, including Senegal, Nepal, Afghanistan, Somalia, and Iran. That's not great company to be in, is it? So from everything I've read, the sale of TikTok is highly, highly unlikely. China is basically saying no way. Or if they did do it, they would sell it without the algorithm, which would basically gut the usefulness of TikTok. Like it or hate it, the algorithm is really what makes TikTok so popular. You know, so we'll see what happens in court. There is time for this to change. And I gave my opinion on this, you know, a few episodes ago. But basically, look, I get it. The Chinese government is a repressive regime. They do have a lot of inordinate control over their companies, which would mean they could have a lot of access to data from ByteDance, even though supposedly ByteDance has gone to great lengths to keep Americans' data outside of China. But at the end of the day, I think this whole thing is just a highly hypocritical and probably xenophobic way to single out TikTok for data collection and the potential for distributing propaganda or mis- or disinformation when all the other social media apps do this as well. They just happen to not be owned by a government we don't like. What we really need, of course, is privacy laws that protect all of us from all apps, no matter where they come from. But all right, I'm not going to quit beating that dead horse and move on. All right, the next one is from The Register, and it's about some new, basically, surveillance legislation. The UK's Contentious Investigatory Powers Bill of 2024 has officially received the King's nod of approval and will become law. Dubbed the Snooper's Charter by critics, it aims to widen the digital surveillance powers of the existing Investigatory Powers Act of 2016, the IPA, used by UK intelligence services, the police, the government, and some emergency services. Before the latest amendments came into force, the IPA already allowed authorized parties to gather swaths of information on UK citizens and tap into telecoms activity, phone calls, and SMS texts. The IPB, this is the new one, the IPB amendments add to the Act's existing powers and help authorities trawl through more data, which the government claims is a way to tackle modern threats to national security and the abuse of children. The UK government has positioned the changes, which include an expanded remit to collect data on UK citizens en masse, as a means to afford intelligence agencies and the National Crime Agency, or the NCA, quote, greater ability and speed, unquote, in responding to threats. Among those alterations is the ability for authorities to surveil targets by gathering their internet connection records. This will allow investigators to determine who connected to what service, such as an app or a website, what phone number they dialed, where they were at the time, and when they did so. The amendments also expand authorities' ability to gather bulk data sets of personal information on individuals who have a low or no expectation of privacy. This includes data such as CCTV footage or images posted to social media. There was hope among the bill's opposers that some of the more controversial changes would be repealed following loud concerns over privacy infringements, but the UK's hardline stance on national security has prevailed. Other key concerns revolve around the IPB's amendment that would force tech companies to consult the UK government before rolling out security updates to software. It's a big one that opposers of the bill think will undermine the security posture of the UK and potentially lead to unnecessarily protracted delays in rolling out key security features, thus making the country a more popular target for cybercriminals. Apple, for example, a company that famously refused to bend even to the FBI after they wanted to crack open the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone, said it would consider pulling iMessage and FaceTime from the UK over fears that it would be forced to weaken security. The IPB, of course, goes hand in hand with the long-running calls to break end-to-end encryption, which the government also claims impedes its efforts to tackle national security threats. The online safety bill was also passed last year after a rocky process that garnered equally loud concerns from privacy campaigners about a so-called spy clause that aimed to capture encrypted private messages. Although the UK government admitted that scanning encrypted chats wasn't quote-unquote technically feasible, it didn't rule out the possibility of invoking a request for the companies to do so in the future, perhaps at a time when, or if, end-to-end encryption becomes illegal in the UK, for example. So all of this just goes to show that we are still fighting the crypto wars, basically. And right now we are losing them because of some scary things happening in the world, some real things, you know, terrorism, child abuse, sex trafficking, drug smuggling. These are all real things that have real consequences, horrible consequences. But in the name of security, we're giving up privacy, and that is just not necessary. There are so many different ways today to track this information and to do investigations without having to do this mass warrantless surveillance. And it's all being done in secret, so we'll probably never know when it's abused, unless some whistleblowers come forward with some hard data, which honestly, I hope happens. All right, moving on. This is again from TechCrunch. And this is about a company you may not have heard of, but I want you to understand the implications that this has for basically all digital services that we use. And it's about a photo sharing community called IM, or E-Y-E-E-M. IM, the Berlin-based photo sharing community that exited last year to Spanish company Freepik, that's a weird verb to use, but I think that means it sold out to, after going bankrupt, is now licensing its users' photos to train AI models. Earlier this month, the company informed users via email that it was adding a new clause to its terms and conditions that would grant it the rights to upload users' content to, quote, train, develop, and improve software, algorithms, and machine learning models, unquote. Users were given 30 days to opt out by removing all of their content from IM's platform. Otherwise, they were consenting to this use case for their work. At the time of its 2023 acquisition, IM's photo library included 160 million images and nearly 150,000 users. The company said it would merge its community with Freepik over time. Despite its decline, almost 30,000 people are still downloading it each month, according to data from App Figures. Once thought of as a possible challenger to Instagram, or at least Europe's Instagram, IM had dwindled down to a staff of 3 before selling to Freepik. Joaquin Abela, CEO of Freepik, hinted at the company's possible plans for IM, saying it would explore how to bring more AI into the equation for creators on the platform. As it turns out, that meant selling their work to train AI models. Section 13 of IM's new terms of service details a complicated process for deletions that begins with first deleting photos directly, which would not impact content that had been previously shared to the IM magazine or social media, the company notes. To delete content from the IM market, where photographers sold their photos, or other content platforms, users would have to submit a request to support@im.com and provide the content ID numbers for those photos they wanted to delete and whether it should be removed from their account as well, or the IM market only. Of note, the notice says that these deletions from IM market and partner platforms could take up to 180 days. Yes, that's right. Requested deletions take up to 180 days, but users only have 30 days to opt out. That means the only option is manually deleting photos one by one. Worse still, the company adds that, and this is another quote from the Terms of Service, "You hereby acknowledge and agree that your authorization for IM to market and license your content according to Sections 8 and 10 will remain valid until the content is deleted from IM and all partner platforms within the time frame indicated above. All license agreements entered into before complete deletion and the rights of use granted thereby remain unaffected by the request for deletion or the deletion." And so it references Section 8. Section 8 is where licensing rights to train the AI are detailed. In Section 10, IM informs users that they will forego their right to any payouts for their work if they delete their account, something users may think to do to avoid having their data fed to AI models. Gotcha. IM's move is an example of how AI models are being trained on the back of users' content, sometimes without their explicit consent. Though IM did offer an opt-out procedure of sorts, any photographer who missed the announcement would have lost the right to dictate how their photos were to be used going forward. Given that IM's status as a popular Instagram alternative had significantly declined over the years, many photographers may have forgotten that they had ever used it in the first place. They certainly may have ignored the email if it wasn't already in a spam folder somewhere. Those who did notice the changes were upset they were only given a 30-day notice and no options to bulk delete their contributions, making it more painful to opt out. And I can guarantee you that was not an oversight. That was almost certainly on purpose. So there's almost nothing you can do when stuff like this happens. Buyouts happen all the time, often without any notice. and the new owner can completely change the terms of service. I love to quote Cory Doctorow here because he calls this the Darth Vader MBA, which MBA, I guess, would be Masters of Business Administration. It's a common degree for people who go into business. And that is, and I wish I could do James Earl Jones justice here, but basically it's, I am altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further. A paraphrase of one of the classic Darth Vader lines from the Star Wars movies. These terms of service change constantly, and they change out from under you. And in almost all cases, it's the kind of thing where, hey, we're changing this, we're letting you know. And by not doing anything at all, you are thereby agreeing to these changes. And if you want to disagree with these changes, you have to jump through a whole lot of hoops. So I don't know whether you are personally a user of IM, but think about what's going on here. I mean, these photographers have uploaded images to this market hoping to sell their wares. And now those images are going to be used to train an AI system, which will probably be used to generate images for somebody else, for which you will get not only no credit for, but certainly not get paid for. So all this to say, something I've been trying to beat the drum on for a long time now, and that is the only data that can't be stolen or abused is data that doesn't exist. So go back, look at all the accounts you've created over the years. The best way to do this is if you're using a password manager, your password manager should have all the credentials for all those sites in it. So if you've forgotten about something you create an account with, you can do that. Otherwise, the other option is, and it's not as easy, search through your email, whatever email you would normally use to sign up for accounts with, and look for keywords like registration or account creation or things like that, and to try to give you an idea of where you might have some of these accounts. And delete them. Delete your data first, actually, if possible, if they give the option. Ask for all your data to be deleted. Get a confirmation for that, and then close those accounts. Data minimization is not just about companies reducing the amount of information they get from you. It's also on you to minimize the amount of data that's actually floating out there, at least to the degree that you can. There has been some talk with app stores, for example, of being able to notify people when the owner of that app changes. We are seeing similar problems with takeover of open source libraries, for example. We talked about that recently where we really dodged the bullet with that XZ or XYUtils library that was taken over. There's also an interesting plugin for web browsers called Under New Management that will alert you when browser plugins have changed owner. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, but I think that should be a mandatory notification. If one of the companies that you are doing business with, certainly any company that has your private information, I think they really should have to inform you of any pending change of ownership so that you can potentially, you know, get your data out before the terms of service are maybe changed out from underneath you. Again, of course, what we really want is a privacy law that protects our data anyway. It's such a mess. All right, next up, yet another story from TechCrunch, actually two in a row, both about healthcare breaches. So the first one's about Kaiser. It says, U.S. health conglomerate Kaiser is notifying millions of current and former members of a data breach after confirming it shared patients' information with third-party advertisers, including Google, Microsoft, and X, formerly Twitter. In a statement shared with TechCrunch, Kaiser said that it conducted an investigation that found, quote, certain online technologies previously installed on its websites and mobile applications may have transmitted personal information to third-party vendors, unquote. Kaiser said that the data shared with the advertisers includes member names and IP addresses, as well as information that could indicate if members were signed into a Kaiser Permanente account or service and how members, quote, interacted with and navigated through the website and mobile applications and search terms used in the health encyclopedia, unquote. Kaiser said it subsequently removed the tracking code from its websites and mobile apps. Kaiser is the latest healthcare organization to confirm it shared patients' personal information with third-party advertisers by way of online tracking code, often embedded in web pages and mobile apps and designed to collect information about the user's online activity for analytics. Over the past year, telehealth startups Cerebral, Monument, and Tempest have pulled tracking code from their apps that shared patients' personal and health information with advertisers. Kaiser spokesperson Diana Yee said that the organization would begin notifying 13.4 million affected current and former members and patients who accessed its websites and mobile apps. The notifications will start in May in all markets where Kaiser Permanente operates, the spokesperson said. in the past, at least, I'm not sure exactly what they're referring to here, but in the past, this would be where Facebook like buttons or Pinterest pin buttons were all over a website. But that's not just that anymore. A lot of these websites and apps come built in with these software development kits that have analytics, which everybody wants, because it tells them how people use and interact with the application, you know, how they click buttons, how they move around from page to page, and things like that. Unfortunately, these things also collect a lot of information about what the user does, information potentially filled in on forms, and IP addresses and times and things like that, all of which are sent back to the third parties providing these analytics libraries, which are advertising companies. I cannot believe we have not learned these lessons by now, and I guess what should be happening is that the companies that make these analytics libraries should maybe have a version of those for healthcare companies and healthcare apps that automatically strip out anything that might be sensitive. I don't know. Again, we need a privacy law, and the HIPAA law, by the way, HIPAA, apparently is not sufficient for this. All right, next up, another one. And this is about a massive ransomware hack with Change Healthcare, which is part of United Healthcare. The ransomware gang that hacked into U.S. tech giant Change Healthcare used a set of stolen credentials to remotely access the company's systems that weren't protected by multi-factor authentication, or MFA, according to the chief executive of its parent company, United Health Group. United Health CEO Andrew Witty provided the written testimony ahead of a House subcommittee hearing on Wednesday, this was last Wednesday, into the February ransomware attack that caused months of disruption across the U.S. healthcare system. This is the first time the insurance giant has given an assessment of how hackers broke into the Change Healthcare system, during which massive amounts of health data were exfiltrated from its systems. United Health said last week that the hackers stole health data on, quote, a substantial proportion of people in America, unquote. Change Healthcare processes health information and billing claims for around half of all U.S. residents. And another quote from Witty, he says, quote, once the threat actor gained access, they moved laterally within the systems to more sophisticated ways and exfiltrated data, unquote. Witty said the hackers deployed ransomware 9 days later on February 21st, prompting the health giant to shut down its network to contain the breach. United Health confirmed last week that the company paid a ransom to the hackers who claimed responsibility for the cyber attack and subsequent theft of terabytes of stolen data. The hackers, known as Ransom Hub, are the second gang to lay claim to the data theft after posting a portion of the stolen data to the dark web and demanding a ransom to not sell the information. So I actually watched a lot of the testimony from this CEO, Mr. Witty. I watched both the Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives coverage of this on C-SPAN because, you know, hey, I'm retired. I could do that in the middle of the day. I was actually kind of live texting with Josh Corman about this as we were both watching this because this is something that he has been championing for years, you know, trying to protect our healthcare systems. And the issue here isn't just that all this data was taken and ransomed. Which, by the way, these bad guys certainly could have retained copies of this, and it may come out again. I mean, just because you paid the ransom for this doesn't mean it's not going to come back and bite you again later. The real issue here is, well, okay, that the security was bad in the first place. And according to Witty's testimony, basically what it sounded like is when they merged with this other company, they brought in the servers from this other company that were quite old, and they missed the fact that this particular server didn't have multi-factor authentication turned on, which was why it was vulnerable. But the fact that the billing systems were down meant that a lot of people couldn't access their healthcare because if the hospital can't get paid, if the pharmacy can't get paid, they're not going to hand out stuff, right? Or they're going to charge you full price for that, and most people can't afford it. So this goes back to what Josh Corman and I'm the Cavalry have been harping about for 10 years or 10 years plus now. And that is how some of these security vulnerabilities have real life or death consequences. There are people that went without medications because of this. So the questions by the folks in Congress, you know, mostly were around remediating this particular thing and, you know, protecting small, even small doctor's offices because they couldn't get paid. And some of these small doctor's offices were like going to go under. We were going to lose doctors. So the company is making loans available. I have to say that Mr. Witty was actually very contrite and very polite as he was being grilled But I didn't see a lot of discussion about what we can learn from this and protecting these solar systems going forward. We really need to be looking at the bigger picture here. This is already sort of in the rearview mirror, and what we need to do is focus on how we make sure this never happens again. All right, next up, this is from Ars Technica. And this is quite the ironic story, and yet it's been something that I've been talking about for years. Hackers abused an antivirus service for 5 years in order to infect end users with malware. The attack worked because the service delivered updates over HTTP, a protocol vulnerable to attacks that corrupt or tamper with the data as it travels over the internet. In other words, notice that it was HTTP and not HTTPS, the S being for secure. The unknown hackers, who may have ties to the North Korean government, pulled off this feat by performing a man-in-the-middle attack that replaced the genuine update with a file that installed an advanced backdoor instead, said researchers from security firm Avast. Escan, that's E-S-C-A-N, an AV service headquartered in India, has delivered updates over HTTP since at least 2019, Avast researchers reported. This protocol presented a valuable opportunity for installing the malware, which is tracked in security circles under the name GuptiMiner. The complex infection chain started when Escan applications checked in with the Escan update system. The threat actors then performed a man-in-the-middle attack that allowed them to intercept the package sent by the update server and replace it with a corrupted one that contained code to install GuptiMiner. The Avast researchers still don't know precisely how the attackers were able to perform the interception. They suspect targeted networks may already have been compromised somehow to route traffic to a malicious intermediary. To lower the chances of detection, the infection file used DLL, or Dynamic Link Library Hijacking, a technique that replaces legitimate Dynamic Link Library, or DLL, files used by most Microsoft apps with maliciously crafted ones that use the same file name. The payload contained multiple backdoors that were activated when installed on large networks. Curiously, the update also delivered XMRIG, an open-source package for mining cryptocurrency. The researchers were surprised that malware that took such pains to fly under the radar would also install a cryptocurrency miner, which by nature is usually easy to detect. One possibility is the attacker's possible connection to Kimsuki, the tracking name for a group backed by the North Korean government. Over the years, North Korean's government has generated billions of dollars in cryptocurrency through malware installed on devices of unwitting victims. The GuptiMiner attack is notable for exposing major shortcomings in Escan that went unnoticed for at least 5 years. Besides not delivering updates over HTTPS, a medium not susceptible to man-in-the-middle attacks, Escan also failed to enforce digital signing to ensure updates hadn't been tampered with before being installed. Representatives of Escan didn't respond to an email asking why engineers designed the update process this way. People who use or have used Escan should check the Avast post for details, and you can find the links in this article from my show notes, on whether their systems are infected. It's likely that most reputable AV scanners will also detect this infection. The implication there obviously being that Escan is not reputable. So this is one of the big reasons why I don't like using third-party antivirus software. And I've written articles on this. It can be kind of controversial. I, on my macOS, don't use any antivirus software, at least none that runs continuously. And I always come back to my bodyguard analogy. When you install software like antivirus software, it has to have full access. You have to give it full permissions. It's like hiring a bodyguard. They need to be able to access everything, the good and the bad. And you are trusting them to be quiet and keep anything to themselves, like when you go to visit your mistress or when you go to your drug dealer. But these antivirus programs themselves, like all software, have bugs or oversights in this case. I mean, this is really just bad. I mean, your software update mechanism for something as crucial as antivirus software must be secure, and HTTP is not secure. Note the lack of the S, and then not even checking that the software you download was valid. All these software updates should be cryptographically signed and validated before ever installed. So this is just horrible. And this is why I have a hard time trusting antivirus software. My general advice is if you're on Microsoft Windows, then use Microsoft's Defender. It comes with it. It's free. It's good. You're already trusting Microsoft anyway. Just use that. For a Mac, I personally don't use anything that does any active scanning. You know, macOS actually has some pretty decent built-in anti-malware functions. They don't really tout them, but they're there. And then I use Malwarebytes if I want like an on-demand kind of a spot check, you know, or that's what I recommend to other people too if they're worried that something may have gotten through the macOS protections. All right, so now let's get to some better news. This is from Bleeping Computer. The Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC, has fined the largest U.S. wireless carriers almost $200 million for sharing their customers' real-time location data without their consent. FCC's forfeiture orders finalize notice of apparent liability issued against AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon in February of 2020. The fine imposed on Monday includes $12 million for Sprint, $80 million for T-Mobile, who eventually merged, $57 million for AT&T, and $47 million for Verizon. An investigation was launched after reports from the largest American wireless carriers disclosed customers' location information to a Missouri sheriff through Securus's location finding service without consent or legal authorization. Despite being informed of the unauthorized access, all four carriers continued to operate their programs without reasonable safeguards to ensure that location-based service providers with access to customers' location information obtained consent. During the investigation, the FCC's Enforcement Bureau found that each of the four mobile carriers sold their customers' real-time location data to aggregators, who then resold this information to dozens of third-party location-based service providers, revealing where their customers were going and who they were. While AT&T, Sprint, Verizon, and T-Mobile all took over 275 days to terminate their location-based service programs after the New York Times report, according to the FCC investigation, Sprint ended it all after 386 days. And finally, this is a quote from the FCC, quote, "In doing so, each carrier attempted to offload its obligations to obtain customer consent onto downstream recipients of location information, which in many instances meant that no valid customer consent was obtained. This initial failure was compounded when, after becoming aware that their safeguards were ineffective, the carriers continued to sell access to location information without taking reasonable measures to protect it from unauthorized access." So again, this is not going to stop until we have privacy laws. All this stuff's just going to keep happening. And I've seen this in many other news stories that I've read here, where what happens is these companies are under pressure to stop collecting this data or stop having it abused by the wrong third parties who are they're selling it to, basically puts the onus on the people they're selling the data to follow privacy laws, not them. This was basically, I think, what happened in the Cambridge Analytica scandal with Facebook. Facebook gave quote-unquote researchers access to extended information from Facebook users. I think it allowed them to see not only information from the requested Facebook users, but also their friends' information, and then put some terms of service around that and says, you know, by the way, don't abuse this data. And that was it. They basically passed the responsibility on to someone else to enforce this and then say, see, look, we did our job. It's not our problem now. All right, moving on. This is from Cybersecurity Dive, a website I hadn't heard before, but it's got some great quotes from Jen Easterly, the CISA director. "The U.S. government and its partners have slowed the swell of ransomware over the last 3 years, Jen Easterly, director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, said Wednesday at an event. But the cyclical and persistent threat ransomware poses requires new ways of thinking, Easterly said, speaking at the Institute for Security and Technology's annual Ransomware Task Force event. Defenders and stakeholders have to turn the lens to software and hardware vendors, according to Easterly." And this is a quote from Easterly, quote, "There's a lot about the villains. There's a lot about the victims. We do not talk enough about the vendors. The way we're going to actually drive down the number of attacks and the number of successful attacks is if we go upstream and ensure that technology that is deployed and delivered is in fact prioritized to be secure. Not features, not speed to market, not driving down costs, but secure. That's why we're in this issue," unquote. Secure by Design, a collective push to shift the responsibility for security in technology products and services to manufacturers and vendors, remains a principles-based work in progress. For now, there's no enforcement mechanisms tied to these guidelines. Officials know they still have work to do downstream, and positive outcomes could take years to materialize. While efforts such as StopRansomware.gov, the Joint Ransomware Task Force, the Pre-Ransomware Notification Initiative, the Ransomware Vulnerability Warning Pilot, and the Known Exploited Vulnerabilities Catalog are not magic solutions, the number of attacks would be much higher without them, Easterly says. CISA's Pre-Ransomware Notification Initiative and Ransomware Vulnerability Warning Pilot have each resulted in about 2,000 notifications since they began in late 2022, Easterly said. Those efforts stopped some attacks from occurring or spiraling into disasters, but ransomware remains a huge problem. Instead of focusing on the victim or why an attack happened, Easterly said stakeholders need to address why vendors are delivering products with common vulnerabilities. So yes, before I go on to the next article about CISA and the great work they're doing, I want to focus on this one because I absolutely agree. There's no software liability. We can take car manufacturers to court if they produce cars that are not safe to drive. Similarly with drugs that are produced or even food that's produced. But for whatever reason, software vendors have gotten off completely scot-free with no ramifications whatsoever. They just put it in their terms of service in so many words that, you know, this is all given as is. We don't warranty this product at all. If there's anything wrong with it, it's not our fault. You're choosing to use this of your own free will, and you accept all the liability. How that ever was really allowed or hasn't been challenged to date is just beyond me. But yes, we absolutely need to focus on secure by design and make sure that our vendors are putting out good stuff. So this next article is from The Record, and it actually talks a little bit more about the programs that I just mentioned in the previous article. A pilot program to proactively notify organizations their devices may be vulnerable to ransomware attacks is already bearing fruit, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, said Thursday. The Ransomware Vulnerability Warning Pilot was unveiled in January 2023 as a program designed to, quote, identify organizations with internet-accessible vulnerabilities commonly associated with known ransomware actors, unquote. The program was mandated under the Cyber Incident Reporting legislation President Joe Biden signed into law in 2022. It is run by the Joint Ransomware Task Force, co-led by CISA and the FBI. CISA said that it made 1,754 notifications last year to organizations with internet-exposed devices vulnerable to attack. Of those, 82 were, quote, patched, implemented a compensating control, or taken offline after notification from CISA. Organizations participating in this no-cost service typically reduce their risk and exposure by 40% within the first 12 months, and most see improvements in the first 90 days. Because the service looks for exposed assets, whether planned or inadvertent, it identifies vulnerabilities that would otherwise go unmanaged, unquote. CISA's data shows that the overwhelming number of notifications were to government facilities and organizations in the healthcare sector. Government entities, which include K-12 schools and districts, higher education facilities, local government organizations, and federal agencies, received 641 notifications, while 444 pertained to healthcare. Organizations in the energy, financial services, and transportation sectors were next highest. So again, this is freaking fantastic. I'm so glad that they are doing this. Again, I'll pull out Josh Corman's name here. I think he was instrumental in getting a lot of this kind of stuff moving when he was there. In particular, this notion of the what's called the Known Exploited Vulnerability Database, or the KEV database. We've talked on this show before when I actually deign to give you the numbers. And we talk about actually registered vulnerabilities under the Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures, or CVE, database. You know, has thousands of these things. You know, every year now we're finding thousands of these and reporting them and documenting them. But in reality, most of those are theoretical. A lot of them haven't actually been exploited in the wild. A lot of them are found and fixed before that ever becomes a problem, or they're just so esoteric or difficult to do, you know, that they just don't actually get exploited. So I think Josh was involved with this. The CISA decided to focus on the subset of those that were actually known to be being currently and actively exploited. Like these are the vulnerabilities that are actually being used right now. So they focused on those, and then they could use their computers and systems to scan the internet, just like the bad guys do, trying to find devices that were exposed to the internet that were vulnerable to these known exploited vulnerabilities, these KEVs. And then this program notifies them and says, hey, you got a problem right here, and here's how you fix that. Hopefully before the bad guys find and exploit it. So anyway, fantastic work. This is all good stuff, and very happy to see this being done. All right, next up, this is also from The Record, and this is just mind-blowing in a very, very good way. Hats off to the UK. 7 years ago, a cyber attack left many of the most popular websites based in the United States inaccessible. For three extended periods on October 21st, 2016, internet users were left without their doses of Twitter, CNN, and Netflix, among other popular sites. Naturally, there was speculation about the powerful threat actors who could have caused such a disruption. But the incident was not conducted by a hostile state. It turned out to be extremely unsophisticated, just a distributed denial-of-service attack targeting Dyn, D-Y-N, a company which provided domain name system or DNS services, a critical part of the internet's communication structure. While the attack was unsophisticated, it was large. The volume of traffic sent to Dyn's servers was generated by a botnet of internet-connected consumer devices from wireless cameras through to Wi-Fi routers. The botnet, called Mirai, after a Japanese cartoon, had been developed by a trio of U.S. citizens barely out of their teens, all of whom were soon arrested. While they pleaded guilty just over a year later, their invention raised the specter of something much more long-lasting. The specter of just how much harm could be caused by sloppy security practices among Internet of Things producers, particularly the widespread use of default usernames and passwords that allowed the Mirai botnet to automatically infect them and spread itself to around 300,000 devices, all of which could be ordered to target anything else connected to the Internet. On Monday, the United Kingdom became the first country in the world to ban default guessable usernames and passwords from these IoT devices. The Product Security and Telecommunications Infrastructure Act of 2022, or PSTI, introduces new minimum security standards for manufacturers and demands that these companies are open with consumers about how long their products will receive security updates for. Manufacturing and design practices mean many IoT products introduce additional risks to the home and business networks they're connected to. In one often cited case, which I'd love to cite myself, described by cybersecurity company Darktrace, hackers were allegedly able to steal data from a casino's otherwise well-protected computer network after breaking in through an internet-connected temperature sensor in a fish tank. Under the PSTI, weak or easily guessable default passwords, such as admin or 12345, are explicitly banned, and manufacturers are also required to publish contact details so users can report bugs. Products that fail to comply with the rules could face being recalled, and the companies responsible could face a maximum fine of £10 million, which is about $12.5 million, or 4% of their global revenue, whichever is higher. Similar laws are being advanced elsewhere, although none have entered into effect. The European Union's Cyber Resilience Act is yet to be finally agreed, but its similar provisions aren't expected to apply within the bloc until 2027. There's no federal law about securing consumer IoT devices in the United States, although the IoT Cybersecurity Improvement Act of 2020 requires the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, quote, to develop and publish standards and guidelines for the federal government, unquote, on how they use IoT devices. Okay, so this is big. So this article just talks about default passwords. It mentions like a little bit about other stuff, but this law has some really detailed and strong cybersecurity protections in it. I'm just going to read a little bit of a summary of what some of the other things in there. So we talked about no default universal passwords. It has to implement a means to manage reports of vulnerabilities. In other words, if security bugs are found, it has to have a way to contact somebody so they can be told that there's a problem. Keep the software updated automatically. Securely store sensitive security parameters. Communicate securely, which probably means encryption where possible. Minimize exposed attack surfaces. Again, fantastic that they're even thinking about this and they put this into the law. Ensure software integrity. This is, goes back to what I was just talking to a minute ago about, you know, digitally signing update files to make sure that they're valid. Ensure that personal data is secure. Make systems resilient to outages. That's fantastic. Again, something that's often missed. Make it easy for users to delete user data. Make installation and maintenance of devices easy. Again, crucial for security, and validate input data. I mean, it's just amazing how much stuff is in there. I want to go read this myself, even though it's kind of long, but I think the first, you could just kind of read the first, maybe I think 30 or 40 pages to get the basic gist of it, but it's absolutely fantastic. And this is not something that's being proposed. This is not, you know, recommendations. These are requirements. So A, that alone by itself is fantastic. And this was very, very well written and it's very comprehensive. But here's the kicker. Even though this is just in the UK, manufacturers, especially hardware manufacturers, are not going to make a different product for the UK than they're going to make for everywhere else. That's just too expensive. So we all around the world actually should benefit from this, assuming these companies don't give up and pull out of the UK market. When these companies inevitably have to comply with this, which I think takes effect immediately or very soon, we're all going to benefit from this. And that is just wonderful. So big, big thanks to the UK for this law. It's going to help all of us and hopefully serve as a template for the rest of us. All right, just two more quick stories. This one's from Wired. The Federal Communications Commission has voted once again to assert its power to oversee and regulate the activities of the broadband industry in the United States. In a 3-2 vote, and I'll come back to that in a minute, the agency reinstated net neutrality rules that had been abandoned during the height of the Trump administration's deregulatory blitz. And this is a quote from the FCC chair, Jessica Rosenworcel. Quote, broadband is now an essential service. Essential services, the ones we count on in every aspect of modern life, have some basic oversight, unquote. The rules approved by the agency on Thursday will reclassify broadband services in the United States once more as common carriers under Title II of the Telecommunications Act, subjecting broadband to the same public utilities style scrutiny as telephone networks and cable TV. That distinction means that the agency can prevent internet service providers from blocking or throttling legal content or letting online services pay ISPs to prioritize their content with faster delivery speeds. But it's difficult, particularly in an election year, to say whether net neutrality is here to stay or whether the FCC's vote is just another inflection point in a regulatory forever war. This reclassification was first attempted by the Obama administration following a lawsuit by Verizon in 2011. The ruling pointed to reclassification as a necessary hurdle in efforts to bring broadband under the scope of the FCC's oversight. The outcome of that case prompted the introduction of the Open Internet Order of 2015, which not only reclassified the industry in line with the court's suggestion, but imposed a slate of new rules with net neutrality serving as the FCC's guiding philosophy. 2 years later, those rules were overturned by the Trump-appointed FCC chair at the time, Ajit Pai, a former Verizon lawyer. So, yeah. So, in the United States, the way these commissions often work is that the heads of these commissions are a panel of people. It's an odd number of people so that the ruling party, the party in control of the executive branch, the White House, the presidency, can pick or nominate the members of these boards, and let's say there's five people on the board. Three of those people will be from the ruling party, and the other two will be from the opposition party. And I even hate phrasing it that way because this stuff should not be political, like at all. This is not bipartisan; it is nonpartisan. But this is the way it works, and that's why so many of these things happen on a 3-2 vote. And for many years, especially during the Trump administration, a lot of these panels weren't even fully staffed. Like they were often the chairperson with the nomination for the chairperson was held up under some, you know, vague reasons, which left the panel at 2-2, an even number, which they could never agree on anything. So nothing ever got done. So anyway, we've gotten past this. The Biden administration has managed to, you know, put some real talented and ambitious people in these chair positions of these key organizations, these government agencies, and they are really getting some great work done. But again, as this article mentions, if the ruling party changes after this next election, all this could just be undone again. I don't know how you fix that. I suppose maybe the way you fix that is with laws, which are kind of harder to overturn than just membership on these committees. But that is one downside of the way things function here in the United States. Especially in recent years where, you know, partisanship has gotten so, so ridiculous. So anyway, for the time being, net neutrality is back. All right. So one more article, and this is back to some, I guess, bad news. It's just kind of indifferent for me, but this will lead nicely into the tip of the week. And this is from Ars Technica. Will Chrome, the world's most popular browser, ever kill third-party cookies? Apple and Mozilla both killed off the user tracking technology in 2020. Google, the world's largest advertising company, originally said it wouldn't kill third-party cookies until 2022. Then in 2021, it delayed the change until 2023. In 2022, it delayed everything again until 2024. It's 2024 now, and guess what? Another delay. Google says it won't turn off third-party cookies in Chrome until 2025, 5 years after the competition. And of course, that just assumes it won't get delayed yet again. So a new blog post cites UK regulations as the reason for the delay, saying, quote, we recognize that there are ongoing challenges related to reconciling divergent feedback from the industry, regulators, and developers, and will continue to engage closely with the entire ecosystem, unquote. The post comes as part of the quarterly reports the company is producing with the UK's Competition and Markets Authority, or CMA. Interestingly, the UK's CMA isn't concerned about user privacy, but instead is worried about other web advertisers that compete with Google. The UK wants to make sure that Google isn't making changes to Chrome to prop up its advertising business at the expense of its competitors. While other browser vendors shut down third-party cookies without a second thought, Google said it wouldn't turn off the user tracking feature until it built in an alternative advertising feature directly into Chrome so it can track users' interest to serve them relevant ads. The new advertising system, called the Topics API and Privacy Sandbox, launched in Chrome in 2023, and Google AdSense is already compatible. The UK is worried that Chrome's new ad system might give Google's ad division an unfair advantage. So we have talked about Topics and its predecessor, Flock, before on the show, and I may need to revisit that at some point. It's actually the new Topics thing in the Privacy Sandbox has a lot of merit. I think it's actually a potentially interesting way to go. But I do agree that what's probably happening here is it's kind of locking in advertisers to work with Google and the Chrome browser in particular to get this functionality, because I'm sure that Safari and Firefox are not going to implement this Topics thing. So advertisers are going to be forced to work with Google on this. And so let's roll right into my tip of the week, and that is, please, for the love of God, quit using Chrome. And here's why. Again, Google's browser is the most popular one on the planet. It's on 67% of all desktops globally. And Chrome is made by Google, which is an advertising company, period, full stop. Almost all of Google's revenue, like 80-90%, is made from advertising. It's an advertising company that just happens to make a web browser called Chrome, a search engine, Google, which we're all familiar with, a mobile operating system, Android, owned by Google, a social media platform, YouTube, also owned by Google, and a whole lot more. So the reason they give away these free products and services is because they use them to mine our information in order to have highly targeted ads, which is a service that they sell. They're an advertising company. What you may not know, or may not remember, because I'm sure I've mentioned this before, is that many of the other web browsers that we use are actually based on Chrome. Chrome has an open source project called Chromium, which is the heart, the engine of the Chrome browser. Again, completely owned and operated by Google, though it's open source software, so I don't know what the licensing is on that. You may or may not be able to clone that and copy it. But you can use it. And a lot of other browsers, instead of starting from scratch, said, you know what, that's freely available. Why don't we just use that? And so Microsoft Edge, Brave, Vivaldi, Opera, DuckDuckGo, many other web browsers that you've heard of, if you've heard of anything that's not Chrome, many of those other browsers are actually still based on the same Google code that runs the Chrome browser. And if you add all of those together, it's more like 85% of the worldwide desktop computer market. Now, it gets a little weird when you start talking about mobile, which a lot of people do use mobile for their web browsing, because there's so many more iPhones out there. It's still not as many as there are Android phones. But, you know, Safari in particular does have a higher stake in the mobile market, but still, Chrome dominates. All right, so the fact that Google has cornered the market on web browsers means that they have an inordinate amount of influence on the way the web functions. There is a group called the W3C, or the World Wide Web Consortium, that's supposed to be this open group of people and engineers and organizations, as well as companies, who get together in committees and propose new protocols and design elements for the web. And they've added features over the years, and they're trying to reach this consensus together in this supposedly, you know, open and free environment to influence, you know, the way the web works and how new features are going to be added, and including things like privacy. But Google owns the browser market. And because of that, if they just choose simply to not implement some of these privacy protocols, for example, that they just won't happen. In fact, there have been documented cases of new protocols and standards that have come out that just never got implemented by Chrome and therefore just died on the vine because the vast majority of people never accessed these features because Google refused to implement them. the W3C is not like a legal body. Like the when they come up with these recommendations and protocols and standards, it's meant to unify everything, but that doesn't mean that you have to implement these things. And so Google, if they don't like it, and because they control everything, they just don't do it. And therefore, a lot of these things never see the light of the day. And some of them actually get reversed. They sit on the W3C and they influence these things. They've got a lot of time and money and engineers to throw at these things and lawyers, and they really can throw their weight around. So my argument for quitting Chrome comes down to two things. First of all, Chrome is a privacy nightmare. It's fairly secure, I'll give it that. But from a privacy standpoint, it's just horrible. And if you don't believe me, I recently saw, of all things, a TikTok video. And I didn't find this because I was on TikTok. I found it from some article that referenced this video on TikTok. Otherwise, I never would have found it. Of this woman who went on to Google and figured out how to show what Google knows about her, or at least what Google thinks it knows about her. And it just blew her away. And she actually has a very quick video. It's really kind of hard to see. You might have to pause it to look at it. But there is a place you can go, and I'm going to encourage you all to do this, even if you buy everything I'm saying. If you've never done this, and you have not turned off personalized ads with Google yet, go to myadcenter.google.com. That's myadcenter.google.com. It used to be something else like My Ad Settings or something, and I think the video in TikTok actually even shows the old URL. But the current one, I believe, is myadcenter.google.com. And the other one, we'll forward to this one anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Go to myadcenter.com. Log in if necessary. If you're not already logged into Google, log in. And if you haven't turned off ad personalization, and there's a big toggle right there at the top of the page. So if it's still turned on the left, you should see this thing that says Manage Privacy. Click on that. And then it will show you the things that it knows about you are things that it has inferred about you, and of course may have gotten wrong. And at least in the case of this TikToker, that list was dozens of things. You know, age, sex, marital status, income levels, all sorts of stuff like that were all in here, and it showed what Google thinks they knew about her. And if you go and you have not turned off personalized ads, then you should be able to see what Google thinks it knows about you. In fact, it'll also show you some of the ads it's shown you, and it probably will be pretty creepy. But if you've already turned it off so you can't see this, or you've got enough privacy tools built into your browser, for example, that may be blocking some of this, you may not see much there. So if you still don't buy it, go to my article, my blog on this. It should be the most recent one. And in there, you'll find a link to this article where you can watch the TikTok video. And you can see what this woman found when she went to check her data there. Okay, so that's argument one. But the second argument, the one I'm really kind of appealing to you today, is that we need diversity. We need competitors to Google. Google has eaten up the market in web browsers. And if they manage to stamp out the remaining competition, then Katie bar the door, they will have nobody stopping them from ruling the web. There will be no alternatives. It's already bad enough, but we must preserve the competition. And to further make my point, Google, for all of its Chrome browsers and Chromium-based browsers, has a standard that all browser plugins for those browsers, not just Chrome, but all the Chromium-based browsers, must follow in order to work. It's called a manifest. And Manifest V2 is the one that's out now, but they've been working on Manifest V3, version 3, and they're forcing web browser extensions or plugins that want to keep working on Chrome or any Chromium-based browser to adhere to Manifest V3 starting in June of this year. Okay, so there are some cool new features in Manifest V3. Great. But Manifest V3 really hobbles the ability for ad blocking extensions to do what they need to do. In particular, my favorite one, uBlock Origin, will basically be, well, neutered is a strong word. It could still do some things. And in fact, they're trying to come out with one called uBlock Origin Lite for the Chromium-based browsers, but it is nowhere near as powerful as the one that you could get for, let's say, Firefox. Because Firefox is outside the Google ecosystem and doesn't have to deal with this Manifest V3 stuff. But 85% of the browsers, the desktop browsers on the planet, will all of a sudden not have the capability to block ads like they used to. And didn't I just say that Google's an ad company? Yeah, I don't think that's a coincidence. So I recommend that you try Firefox. Brave is great. As a privacy browser, it's wonderful, but in this particular case, my argument for supporting diversity and competition in the browser market is we need to support non-Chromium browsers. Now, if you're on Apple, you've got Safari. Safari is great. That's probably not going to go anywhere. But I still want there to be competition for everybody else. And I'm on a Mac, but I still use Firefox. I prefer that over Safari. So the way to support them, first of all, is to use it. Download and use Firefox. Switch from Chrome or whatever else you're using now. Switch to Firefox. And if you've got a bunch of bookmarks or favorites or other data and settings, Firefox has a tool that will let you import all of that from your current browser and bring it right over. So it'll be like you never left. So you don't have to worry about that. You can also do this on mobile. Firefox has got an iOS and an Android browser as well. So don't just do it on your desktop, do it everywhere and give it a try. Most browsers, unless it's some really kind of weird niche feature or function, do the same thing. And I think you'll quickly get used to Firefox and won't even notice the difference. Except that your privacy will be in a much better position and you'll be supporting a much needed competitor to Google's Chromium dominance. Now, if you want, there are two other browsers you could look at that are based on Firefox that you might also use. One's called LibreWolf, and another one's from Mulvad, the VPN maker. They also make a great browser. And the Mulvad browser really is kind of like the Tor browser minus the Tor network. And the Tor browser also is based on Firefox. That's one that I can't really recommend for everybody because that's a very, very strict privacy browser that has a lot of inconveniences. But you could try that too if you want. And then on top of that, I would just recommend that you install the uBlock Origin plugin and maybe Privacy Badger from the EFF as well. But with uBlock Origin and Firefox settings out of the box, it is a very, very private and very secure browser, and it's not Google. And if you really want to kick it up a notch and you really want to support Firefox, then I'll give you two more suggestions. First of all, convince your friends and family to try Firefox too. We really, really need to get the adoption of this up. But also, you can just donate directly to Mozilla, who is the maker of Firefox. I'll make sure I put a donation link in the show notes. But at the end of the day, what really is going to help is moving away from Chrome, getting more people to use Firefox. So one last comment, if you like the idea of getting rid of Google products, I have a whole series of articles on de-Googling your life. You can find a link to that in the show notes or just go to my website, Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons, and search on D-Google and you'll find them there. So there you have it. There's your news and your tip of the week. So I've got some great interviews coming up. One will be with Byron Tao. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Who's the author of a book called Means of Control, which I am just starting to read now. And actually, we're reading that as part of our Patreon or patron book club. So that will be coming down in the future. We've got a lot of other great interviews in the works. But next week, we're finally going to get our interview with Dina Temple-Raston from NPR and the Click Here podcast. We're going to be talking about the Ukraine cyber war with Russia, which has some really fascinating stories. And the one after that will be the interview with Naomi Brockwell, which is also a fantastic interview. So a lot of other great ones are in the works. Subscribe if you haven't, and then you won't miss any of it. New patrons are still welcome. I'm still giving out the promo codes for if you come in at the Knight Errant level or above. So if you're interested in that, you can become a patron. Go to firewallsdontstopdragons.com, go to the support tab, and that will give you the information you need there. All right, everybody, that will do it for this week. Take care out there, stay safe, and until next time, as always, don't get caught with your drawbridge down.